our topic today is bankruptcy. Bankruptcy, the concept that as it appears in modern culture and modern law, and how halacha treats, how Jewish law treats bankruptcy. F. Scott Fitzgerald famously wrote, "There are no second acts in American lives," which mostly is quoted to point out that there are second acts in American lives. Politicians fall from grace and are reinstated. And in the economic sphere, we have bankruptcy. We have prominent figures who declare bankruptcy and rocket back to become titans of industry and finance. Our current chief executive has, as he put it, brilliantly used the laws of his country several times, or as other people put it, declared bankruptcy, not personal bankruptcy, his company's bankruptcy a number of times. Bankruptcy is part and parcel of modern economic life. It's a bankruptcy discharge, bankruptcy reorganizations. We'll discuss them a little bit more as we go. But it's a fact of economic life that under certain circumstances, you declare personal bankruptcy, companies declare bankruptcy, and you do get another chance. You can start again and have another try at economic success. There are a variety of rationales. The law and its interpreters offer, economists offer, for why bankruptcy is a good idea. There is the most important paper on Jewish law and bankruptcy by Professor Steven Resnikoff collects 6 or 8 or 10 different rationales for bankruptcy from congressional records, from lawyers, from judges, about why bankruptcy is a good idea, ranging from the cold-bloodedly economic to it's good for the economy to have to kind of get it out of the system and move on. It helps credit be allocated more efficiently if creditors know that they're subject to bankruptcy, losing money in bankruptcy, to humanity and compassion. We want to lift the weight of debt off somebody and give them another chance. To preventing antisocial behavior. People are desperate. They'll do desperate things. We want to give them the chance to just say enough and just start over. All kinds of reasons why society has given for why bankruptcy is a good idea. The question that we're going to be dealing with today is, what is the opinion of halacha, of Jewish civil law, toward bankruptcy? We hear cases all the time. Not that often, thank God, but we do hear cases where one Jew sues another Jew for debts, and the first Jew says, "I'm sorry, I owe you the money, it's true, but I'm filing for bankruptcy, so I'm not going to pay you." And the first Jew says, "Okay, but we're Jews, and we follow the Torah, and we follow Jewish law, and Jewish law has no notion of bankruptcy." And the debtor will say, "Well, we live in the United States of America, where bankruptcy is, as we've said, a fact of modern economic life." So what is the Jewish law perspective on bankruptcy? Do we recognize it? Do we not recognize it? Do we recognize it somewhat? That's what we're going to explore today. At the bottom of all this, aside from economic rationales and aside from technicalities in Jewish law and secular law, as we're going to discuss, at the core of our issue is, really, do we think bankruptcy is fundamentally fair and moral, and do we think it's just being reasonable and fair to a debtor, or on the other hand, do we think it's unfair to the creditor? The creditor lent the money, he had the expectation of getting paid back. The guy may have assets left over. Bankruptcy doesn't mean that we necessarily take every penny away from you and give it to the creditors. He might have money. He might still have a job. He might be making money. The argument is that it's very unfair to creditors. So we all probably have moral opinions as to whether bankruptcy is fair, is not fair, is sometimes fair. It's fair in certain cases, but should be modified to cover more cases, to be more restrictive, less restrictive. So that's what we're going to focus on today. Many of us have probably had stories personally or friends, or we know of cases that bankruptcies have come up, and we generally have opinions as to whether bankruptcy law is a good idea, not a good idea. And as we'll see, this is going to be one of the key issues that's going to be discussed in Jewish law itself, which is we are going to be more inclined to recognize bankruptcy even within a framework established by secular law if we think it's fair and a good idea. We'll be less likely to respect it if we think it's not a good idea. So obviously, as in many areas of halacha in Jewish civil law that deal with kind of real-world economic scenarios, the halacha itself is going to reflect moral judgments, economic judgments about whether bankruptcy is a good idea or a bad idea, and a lot of it is going to hinge on the attitudes of rabbinic scholars as to what they think of the fundamental ethical rationales behind bankruptcy. So first, to cover briefly what I'll call native halacha. As we mentioned earlier, Jewish law often takes into account prevailing economic culture, prevailing custom, prevailing law. But before we get to any of that, in the absence of any such law, if we were to have our own sovereign societies, our own economies that are based on Jewish law. Is there any native provision in Jewish law for bankruptcy? This is a pretty easy question to answer. The answer is no. In Jewish law, there is generally, almost always, no statute of limitations on debt collection. You can simply ignore a debt for 50 years, make no communication, no billing, no invoices, no reminders, and then 50 years later, 100 years later, come back out of the blue and say, by the way, you owe me $10,000, never been paid, it is outstanding, payable immediately, please pay now. That is perfectly legitimate. Might not be a good idea, we don't recommend you do that, but debts do not evaporate if they aren't collected. There is no presumption of debt forgiveness generally. Generally, debts remain just in stasis. They're just there. They don't go away. You can collect the debt indefinitely.
And Shemitah Yovel?
Shemitah and Yovel, yes.
That's what I was...
So the one exception, the one exception that Jewish law does have is the idea of debt forgiveness on Shemitah. Shemitah is the seventh year. Every 7 years is Shemitah. Then Yovel cycles, but just keep it simple with Shemitah. Every 7 years is Shemitah. Shemitah has basically two, Shemitah sometimes called Shabbos in the Torah. It has certain similarities to Shabbos, a day of rest. We don't work a year of rest. We don't work the fields. So there are basically two sets of laws that pertain to Shemitah. One has to do with agriculture, only relevant in Israel. It has to do with not farming and not exercising ownership and possession about the produce of the field. The other is debt forgiveness. Debts are forgiven in the seventh year. This was practiced back in temple times, and various rationales have been offered by the commentators for why the Torah instructs us to forgive debts in the seventh year. The most obvious reason is, you know, similar to bankruptcy. It's meant to give people a second chance to just clear, wipe out debts after 7 years and let people start again. There are other theories. Some associate the debt forgiveness with the ban on agricultural work. They say the farmers were typically taking loans to operate their farms, and since they weren't making any money in the seventh year because they weren't farming, they couldn't service the debts in the seventh year, so the Torah said Shemitah. A little hard to understand why the Torah would mandate forgiveness rather than just a one-year moratorium on debt payments, but some commentators have argued it was linked to agriculture. There is even an opinion of Rabbi Yonasan Eibschitz, a leading European moral and halachic thinker of several centuries ago. He argued the Torah doesn't want man to forget that his ultimate goal in this life is spiritual. You do have to make a living to support yourself, but that shouldn't be your primary goal. The Torah deliberately is instituting Shemitah to cripple economic activity. You know, we know today you can't really run a large-scale business without some kind of debt financing. By forcing loans to be canceled after 7 years, the Torah is deliberately, consciously, intentionally hobbling commerce. It's preventing you from growing your business into huge, large-scale affairs, because the Torah wants you to remember you make a living in order to engage in more important pursuits, spiritual pursuits, religious pursuits, and not to spend all your life just making more money. But in practice, this is all in theory. Shemitah was a mitzvah, a commandment that was applicable in biblical times. In practice, beginning with the Talmudic period, Shemitah became eliminated as a practical operational halacha. The rabbis in Talmudic times already saw that Shemitah was causing problems. Today, conservatives often often criticize well-meaning social legislation by pointing out that there are always going to be unintended consequences, which are often worse than the problem that laws were meant to solve. Now, that's a critique that sometimes is correct and sometimes is not correct, but that seems to be what happened to Shemitah. The Torah, this was God's law, but the Torah instituted Shemitah to make things easier for the debtors or to, you know, prevent people from getting too involved in commerce. But certainly in terms of lightening the burden on debtors, Shemitah began to have the opposite effect, as many economists would have predicted. It says that people stopped lending. People knew that they wouldn't get the money back, so instead of lending and then wiping out the debt and letting the farmers have another chance, they simply weren't lending money and credit was drying up. Now, the Torah does explicitly tell you that you can't do this. You're not allowed to do that. You have to lend the money even though you're risking losing it, but human beings, being the fallen creatures that they are, they didn't always listen to the Torah, and credit began to dry up, and the rabbi saw that the harm being caused outweighed the good, apparently, so the rabbis instituted a procedure called prosbul, which is a formal document executed by the creditor, which basically allows him to override Shemitah. It's kind of a legal formality, like selling of chametz and others, that it's a rabbinic mechanism by which Shemitah can be ignored. Prusbel began to be practiced, and indeed, in later centuries, in the medieval period, Shemitah's ksafim, the forgiveness of debts, began to be ignored entirely. For the last 800 years or so, certainly in Ashkenazic countries, European countries where many of us come from, Shemitah was completely ignored. Rabbinic authorities struggled to understand why. There are a variety of reasons given, but they didn't even do prusbels, right? They just began to completely ignore Shemitah. And many Ashkenazic authorities have said that for various reasons, Shemitah's ksafim is no longer in force. Today, many people do write prusbels, but again, a prusbel is trivial to do. It can take 5 minutes, and you may not even need a prusbel. So in practice, Shemitah's ksafim has not been a significant force in shaping economic activity and regulating debts for many centuries, both because of the possibility of prusbel as well as because the Ashkenazic tradition that we just don't practice Shemitah. So Shemitah, in theory, very much is a protection, and ideally God wanted it to be a protection which would have functioned in some ways similar to bankruptcy legislation, but Shemitah is not a practical concern today.
Do we know when that seventh year is? And is it the same 7 year for everybody, or the seventh year from when you made the loan?
That's an excellent question. So the second question, it is not 7 years from the loan. It is a calendrical definition. It is the seventh year. Do we know when it is? So that is a good question. As with most things in Judaism, there is debate about it. There are at least four different opinions as to what year in the current calendar Shemitah is. The Jewish tradition, Jewish law, has settled on one of them as being normative. So you go to Israel today, for example, there is 1 year which is recognized as a year where they either do various ways to resolve or follow the halachic problems associated with agriculture. And debt forgiveness, too, to the extent that it's practiced, to the extent that we write prusbel, there is 1 year that we picked. On the other hand, if you study academically, you study the codes of Jewish law, you will see that there are a variety of opinions. Like many issues which are practical, eventually the tradition settles on one, although even relatively recently there were still those who argued that the existence of other years does have certain ramifications in the halakhic process. But the answer is we're not absolutely sure, but we've settled on one as a matter of normative law. This is absolutely true, that given that the Torah does have Shemitah, and even though the rabbis felt it necessary for practical reasons to provide, facilitate means of getting around it, clearly the Torah is trying to tell you something, although as we've said, there are very different understandings of what the Torah wants to tell you, but the Torah is trying to tell you something about not being in an Ayn Randian kind of unfettered, pure capitalist, let the economically strongest man win and trample everyone else underneath him. The Torah clearly is against such a society. Exactly, what the Torah tells you, and the Rabbi Yonasan Eibschitz again makes this point. He says he was very much critical of those who didn't even bother writing prusbels. He says it's such a beautiful philosophical and moral idea. If we would hear such an idea among the secular philosophers, we would think it's a great idea. We would adopt it ourselves. And here we have our own native version of it. He says it's such a lofty and inspiring and noble ideal. At the very least, we should write prusbels to remember Shemitah and to remember that there's an ideal of debt forgiveness and so on, he says. So yes, it very much is an ideal. It very much should inform our decisions to the extent that we have a choice as creditors of how to treat our debtors. It certainly should inform our decisions. But as a matter of practical binding law, it has limited impact, although certainly aspirationally it is an important thing to remember. There is one other area of native halacha. Halacha does give certain protections toward debtors. That is what we call in Jewish law, misadrin lebalchov. That is that we do not, even in a case where a debt is collected by the courts, by Jewish courts, by any court, we do not literally take the shirt off the person's back. We do allow certain assets to remain in the possession of the debtor, but it is relatively little. It might include the home. It might include some basic clothing, maybe some professional equipment. So similar to bankruptcy law, as we'll discuss soon, where the law does allow in bankruptcy law, there's the homestead exemption, which the house is usually protected except for things like tax liens and mortgages and foreclosures and so on. So the law also typically exempts certain categories of assets from bankruptcy. from creditors taking it. The halacha does have this, even though we have no formal bankruptcy procedure, Jewish law does exempt certain asset categories from seizure. But again, beyond that, there is no bankruptcy. And even these exemptions, these are temporary and ongoing. The debt is never discharged. A person has no assets except his house and his shirt. So we won't take his house and his shirt. But 20 years down the line, he comes into more money. He's successful. We'll just go take whatever additional money he got. The debt is always remains in force. Can always be collected anytime the creditor finds assets belonging to the defendant. Yes?
So the debts that you're talking about are between Jewish people, so there's no interest involved.
Right.
So it's not so worried the person's doing, I know we don't say the favor, God gives you what you're supposed to have. But, I mean,
That's a good point. That certainly, historically, traditionally, in Jewish law, interest is forbidden. That's the biblical rabbinic prohibitions of usury, of taking interest. So typically, in Talmudic time, Jewish debts did not accrue interest. So the monies being collected were typically principal. Once again, history has kind of taken us past biblical law. As some of you may know, there is a procedure called the Heteriska, which is a legal formalism that allows us to, in practice, charge interest with certain restrictions. But functionally, Jews today do construct loans between each other that in which interest does accrue, interest is charged, and this can be facilitated via the execution of a heteriska. It's not quite as trivial as a prosbul. This one should be done by a knowledgeable expert, and there will be certain ramifications for the loan. It's not quite the same as an ordinary modern American loan with interest, but in practice today, Jews do have loans with interest, although yes, historically they didn't. Historically, loans were interest-free, and once again, as Ray Winter said, once again, we should at least be looking to the laws of interest for the Torah's ideal about how Jews should relate to each other. But yes, historically, Jewish loans did not have interest, and many of the early discussions were discussing principal-only loans, although today, bankruptcy situations between Jews might very well involve something which technically is not interest, but practically behaves a lot like interest, and the bankruptcy discussion will be relevant to those outstanding payments also.
I mean, in an economic sense, in biblical times, I think you really had a concept of inflation. So you didn't have the depletion of the asset value over time. So therefore, without interest, that's fine. You're preserving the asset, so to speak, with the capital. Whereas today, that's not
the truth. So that's an interesting question. The notion of inflation or the notion of currency fluctuations vis-a-vis, you know, sorry?
Yeah, the Gemara talks about it.
Yeah, so getting to that, right? So it is true that the notion of inflation, the way we define it as movements of currencies against, let's say, the consumer price index, against baskets of goods and services, isn't a concept that's as clearly defined in the Talmud. But, however, as several people here are pointing out, the Talmud does have a fairly sophisticated discussion of currency movements. It discusses currencies moving against each other. It does discuss currencies moving against goods without defining necessarily, well, you define it as 30 goods and services, or without using terms like $1977 or whatever. The Talmud does discuss the idea that one's capital, one's initial investment in a loan may not be preserved insofar as prices move. It is actually one of the most difficult discussions in the Talmud, understanding it on its own terms and relating it to modern concepts. So, yeah, although modern terminology isn't used, there definitely was recognition that things were not totally stable and prices did move. Yeah, but this is something that will take us a little bit far afield. But basically, this is the native Jewish law background of bankruptcy. There is no bankruptcy proceeding with the exception of Shemitah, which is not in practice today in any practical sense, and with the exception of Misadrin, that we leave certain assets to the debtor. Beyond that, it's fair game pretty much for the creditor to collect debts wherever and whenever he finds assets belonging to the debtor.
But I also never had an account like such a thing like that was popular until recently, somebody in debtor's prison or something like that.
Yes, this is true. On the other hand, the worst.
No, right.
That's very specific.
No, you couldn't pay the debt. It's only the purchaser pays the debt. He's now has to work.
Steals. It's a very specific thing.
No, it's not only stealing. It's also that's my research said that it was also if you are a creditor, you can take the guy to court, and the judge can order him to be.
You could appeal to a gross one.
So a couple of words on this, a couple of words on debtor's prison and eved ivri. There is in biblical law the concept of eved ivri, that someone is sold. The Talmud rules in general that is limited, as I understand it, to cases of theft. There is malchar atzmo, someone can sell himself under pressure. There is on the contrary, there is a famous doctrine established by the medieval Ashkenazic authorities that establish enormous protections, tremendous protections for debtors against being forced into servitude. The Rabbeinu Tam, one of the leading scholars of Ashkenaz, was asked about whether an insolvent debtor can be forced to work for pay, not even work as a serf, work for market rates or whatever it is in order to pay back a debt. Rabbeinu Tam essentially established a fundamental anti-slavery principle in Jewish law. The Torah writes, Ki li b'nei Yisrael avadim, that Jews are the servants of God, and the Talmud elaborates on that, avadai heim, v'lo avadim la'avadim, Jews are servants only to God, and Jews have no terrestrial masters. Rabbeinu Tam elevates that into a fundamental anti-slavery doctrine that says a debtor cannot be forced by the court into any kind of involuntary servitude. Certainly not jail, and not even into involuntary servitude, to the extent that Rabbeinu Tam also ruled that when it comes to alimony, maintenance of a spouse, or maybe children, a husband cannot be forced to work. If he has assets, the assets can be seized, but a court cannot first force a husband to work because forcing an insolvent debtor to work would violate the Torah's strictures against slavery. only eved ivri, and even eved ivri, as Ray Winter said, is fairly limited in very specific circumstances like theft. So Rabbeinu Tam ruled as a matter of practical halacha that an insolvent debtor can never be forced to work. When I was working volunteering as a dayan, as a rabbinical court judge, we once had a case. Creditor hauled an insolvent debtor into court, into Beis Din, rabbinic court, and said, you owe me money. So defendant, what do you say? No contest, I owe the money. So why don't you pay? I don't have the money. So we asked plaintiff, do you accept his claim that he has no money? He said, yes. So we said, so why are you here? What do you want us to do exactly if he has no money? So plaintiff said, okay, I have influence, I have a certain job, I can either hire him myself or I have influence over another job opening, I would like him to take this job. And I won't take all his salary, I'll take 10% of his monthly income or whatever it is until he gets, currently he wasn't working, he wasn't bringing any money, and if he takes this job, he'll at least get something, and I'll gradually pay back the loan. So we asked the defendant, will you take this job? And he said no. We asked him why. He came up with a variety of reasons. It seemed to us that it was more a status and social thing. The job was not a prestigious job. It was kind of low on the socioeconomic status. It was a perfectly honorable job, and it wasn't something that he could brag about to his friends that that's what he was doing. So the question was, can we force him to take the job? And the basic answer is no, we cannot, because the Rabbeinu Tam's principle is accepted as normative halacha that we cannot force an insolvent debtor to take a job. We can encourage him. We can apply moral suasion. The Chazon Ish, a leading 20th century authority, has ruled that the insolvent debtor has a strong moral obligation. Halacha has a very strong moral opprobrium attaches to someone who chooses not to pay a debt that he can pay, even in a case where the court can't compel him, that love a rush of lo yishalem, someone who borrows and does not pay where he's at fault, is considered a scoundrel, a villain. So certainly we can tell him that you have a strong moral obligation to do whatever you can to pay, but to force him to work, that, as a matter of accepted law, we cannot do. And that's pretty much the standard halacha. So we certainly have no notion of debtor's prison. We don't even usually have any notion of forcing somebody to accept employment. There are some contemporary authorities who rule that today we do force people to work, that this rule against involuntary service applied in medieval times where there was social stigma attached to being a laborer, and householders and kind of burghers and small landowners were on a higher social status. It was considered somehow lower class to have to work for a living. While today, where it's normal, middle class, most people in the world work for their living, have employers today, it's a perfectly acceptable thing to do, and today we will force people to work. So as a matter of actual halacha, it is debated, and we can debate whether how a court should actually rule today. But there's a very strong anti-slavery tradition. So on the one hand, while we have no notion of bankruptcy, we will seize the assets. On the other hand, we certainly won't throw them in prison generally, and it is... doubtful as to whether we'll even compel him to accept employment if he does not wish to do so. So far, native halacha has no real notion of bankruptcy. So what do we do as a practical sense in a case where we've had litigation like this in rabbinic court too, where people have come in, plaintiff says, you owe me money, defendant says, that's nice, but I declared bankruptcy. Plaintiff says, I don't see that in Shulchan Aruch. I don't see anything about bankruptcy in Jewish codes of law. We're Jews. Follow halacha and pay me what you owe me. Defendant says, I want to brilliantly use the laws of my country and not pay you any money. Even though I have assets that I theoretically could give you, I don't have to under the law. So what will a Beis Din do in such a case? So this basic question has been debated, discussed at some length for about half a millennium since the 16th century. Bankruptcy as a feature of economic life apparently existed in well-defined, documented forms for at least that long. Jewish scholars, I'm not an expert in the history of bankruptcy law, but Jewish sources have been debating different types of bankruptcy protections and rules for at least five, six centuries. Many of these early discussions did not really concern what we consider bankruptcy today in the sense of a discharge, in the sense of a permanent erasure of debt. They discussed more what we would call reorganizations. People often use Chapter 11 as a kind of colloquialism for bankruptcy. Bankruptcy has lots of chapters. There are something like 13 chapters in the bankruptcy code, of which four of them deal with actual bankruptcy, 7, 11, 12, 13. Kicking out the one that's specific to farmers and small fishermen. There's an entire chapter on that one, apparently. That's 12, I think. The two common ones are pretty much 7 and 11. 7 is what they call liquidation, which is the simplest form, the most common one for individuals. Basically, you turn over all non-exempt assets to the court immediately. It goes pretty quickly. They give the trustee, gives them the court, the trustee. They give them all to the creditors. And at that point, everything else is erased, and you start over again. Chapter 11 is more of a reorganization. You don't give over all the assets. You devise plans for paying back the money, extensions, different terms, and so on. And then the creditors sign off on it, and the court signs off on it, and so on. That's a more complicated procedure, but the business can keep on going as a viable concern during the... That's when you hear about emerging from bankruptcy. It can take a short time, a long time, depending on the complexity. But basically, without getting into all the legal details, bankruptcy has these two aspects. One of them is liquidation, where debts are just erased, assets are taken, and then you start again. Reorganizations are more complicated, where the debts are possibly preserved, but they're restructured and different amounts of money are paid on different schedules. The earliest rabbinic literature, going back to, as I said, the 16th century or so, deals more with these kinds of reorganizations. A person had assets, but his assets weren't sufficient to cover all his debts. And there were a number of different creditors, and they were arguing about how the limited assets should be allocated, and whether any credit should be extended, and so on. So going back to, let's say, Turkish societies, many of the early authorities who discussed bankruptcy were Sephardic Turkish authorities in what today would be Turkey, Greece, Yugoslavia, the old Ottoman Empire. And they established kind of the halachic precedent for bankruptcy. They basically said that we follow prevailing commercial custom. Whatever the laws and mores were in commercial culture back then, these are binding upon Jewish litigants also, upon Jewish creditors and defendants too. Again, they were mostly talking about reorganizations, not outright liquidating the debts, but about accepting different schedules or about accepting different divisions of the current assets. Then halacha would normally require, Jewish law has its own rules normally for how assets are divided when there aren't enough to satisfy all the creditors. The customs were obviously not always the same as Jewish law. And beginning with Rabbi Shlomo Kohen, the Marshach in the 16th century, and proceeding for hundreds of years, the Sephardim established a Jewish law recognizes these proceedings, not again because they necessarily were consistent with Jewish law, but because there is a fundamental rule in Jewish civil law, in Choshen Mishpat, that minhag, that prevailing custom, carries tremendous weight in establishing Jewish law. Jewish law incorporates prevailing custom, certainly in questions and disputes that arise out of consensual relationships, out of deals, out of contracts that were made between consenting parties. The assumption is that their agreement should be governed by whatever customary framework existed. If customary framework included bankruptcy rules, reorganizations, and so on, then their contract implicitly incorporates those rules under the halachic doctrine of minhag. This was how things worked for a long time. In the 18th or 19th century, Sephardic authorities began to debate the question of whether this could even extend to a complete discharge, not just to a reorganization, but simply to wiping out debts and erasing debts. And here we find strong disputes. Some felt that that's fundamentally unfair, that's gzeila. They felt that's theft. You cannot have a custom that legitimizes something so fundamentally unfair. They focused on the unfairness to the creditors, that no matter who cares if it's the custom, you can't have a custom that simply legitimizes something that is so logically, morally illegitimate. And they said such customs are ignored. There is precedent in Jewish law sometimes for ignoring customs that are deemed to be fundamentally unfair. While other authorities said, no, there's nothing unfair about it. Creditors take the risk. They know the risk going in, and these laws were designed to balance, again, bankruptcy law is all about balancing the interests and fairness to the creditor with the interests and being fair to the debtor with the good of society in general, as we discussed earlier. So in general, these are fair rules. They might not be exactly what Jewish law provided, but these are reasonable and fair rules, and there's no reason that customs shouldn't extend to ratify these types of arrangements too, as long as these are the prevailing customs. That is what the custom says, and that's probably the more dominant view, that whatever bankruptcy law or custom or convention does apply, is commonly practiced in a given culture, will be accepted by halacha as binding, also incorporated under the mechanism of minhag. Now, one important point is made by various contemporary authorities, our own Rabbi Breidowitz, Rav Heinemann, other authorities, Rav Moshe Heinemann of Baltimore, other authorities. They've pointed out that if we're not dealing with any fundamental acceptance of secular law, we're not dealing with any native halacha rule of bankruptcy, we're just incorporating commercial culture, they argue that it depends on the character of the transaction. If we're dealing with large, sophisticated entities, corporate entities who have lawyers and experts on staff, they know what they're doing, they know the law, they expect their business to be run on industry standards, on commercial principles, then yes, then we can argue that the minhag, the custom, becomes incorporated under the rule of minhag. However, when you're dealing with more intimate, more informal, personal loans, a relative, a close friend, you both trust each other, you're not expecting everything to be done with the hands off. Some people try to do business with their friends also like that. Some people would rather everything be regulated by strict commercial rules. But these rabbis argue that in personal, informal contexts, very often the expectation of the parties are different. They expect things to be based on more intuitive rules or by halakhic rules. They don't expect it to be dragged into court. Although, as we all know, sometimes family things do end up in court. Nevertheless, there are a number of contemporary authorities who rule that the power of minhag, of custom, is much less applicable when dealing with these types of situations, because they aren't meant to be governed by the same customs that govern professional, formal, commercial transactions. Some of them focus on the question of whether the creditor is a simple person or a large professional commercial entity like a corporation. Some focus more on whether the debtor is. But either way, a number of rabbis make this point that we have to distinguish the character of the loan, the context of the loan, in order to decide whether to apply minhag, prevailing custom.
It seems to be making the distinction between minhag and minhag of machus.
Yes.
If it would be the former, then you could make that type of distinction. But if
yes.
It would be
yes.
The latter, then the distinction doesn't help.
Yes.
Also, a related point is that just corporations versus a person, not as far as incorporating minhag, as responsibility, how would Allah see a corporation? No, Mitt Romney passed them already that corporation are people.
I think you're thinking of Citizens United, but
So
it's dealing with both these questions. First question, Ray Winter is pointing out, quite cogently, that there is a big difference between the mechanism by which halacha would incorporate and recognize secular law, secular custom. We've been focusing on the long tradition of minhag, of custom. The halacha incorporates prevailing custom, whatever the source of the custom is, whether the source of the custom is the law, whether the source of the custom is common law, which just develops on its own, whether the source of the custom is simply industry standards and commercial customs that develop on their own. But halacha has another mechanism by which it incorporates secular law, and that is the principle, the Talmudic principle of Dina de Malchus Adina. Literally, the law of the government, the law of the king, is binding upon Jews under an explicit Talmudic doctrine, rendering unto Caesar what is Caesar's. So halacha often incorporates secular law into halacha too. And as Ray Winter is pointing out, the question of whether we would incorporate prevailing custom and law into informal personal contexts would depend very much on which of these two rationales we're following. If it's minhag, so as I've been explaining, minhag would depend on whether the context of a given loan was one that was expected by the parties to govern, to be governed by custom or not. On the other hand, if the principle is dina malchus dina, the halacha simply wholesale incorporates bodies of secular law into the halacha under this rule, then it can be argued that it doesn't matter what the context is, as long as the law clearly governs this case too, it doesn't matter what the parties thought. Halacha itself on its own simply incorporates the law into the halacha too. Another important distinction has to do with bankruptcy questions or other types of questions that arise out of non-consensual arrangements. For example, loans that have to do with tort litigation, malpractice. If you owe somebody money, not because of any contract, but because his car hit your car or something like that, these type of debts, they don't arise out of any voluntary association between the parties. They arise out of the laws of torts, the laws of injuries, the laws of hezek, we say in the Torah. There's no contract between the parties that can be said to be governed by minhag. It just the law itself, halacha itself, establishes certain obligations for injury, for other types of behavior. So again, din malchus adina, if it applies, the law of the land is the law, applies in these cases too. Minhag, some of these contemporary authorities have argued, is not applicable because the obligation does not arise out of any mutual consensual contractual obligation. It isn't quite that simple, just one second, it isn't quite that simple because in many areas in Jewish civil law, minhag, the notion of prevailing custom, does apply even in cases that arise out of non-consensual agreements. It's more controversial and there are more exceptions to that, but in many areas of halacha, there are many rulings that indicate, even in cases like car accidents or other scenarios, that minhag, prevailing custom, whether or not derived from law or whether derived from other sources, will control even if it is not based on any consensual agreement. So there is still some possibility of applying minhag, even in such cases, although the authorities I've been quoting are take for granted that it will not, at least in this case. Yes?
A number of personal bankruptcies that occur nowadays are the result of medical bills, particularly where illnesses and so on border on or are in fact life-threatening. Where does this argument fall on that? Because it's not like an accident, my car hit your car, it's not like I intentionally borrowed money. Does this not complicate the entire bill process?
So the question is whether debts that are incurred for medical expenses are treated differently, have any special treatment in halacha than other debts that are contracted. It's a difficult question. On the one hand, in a very technical, legal sense, they are contracted willingly. Every time you step into the doctor, he hands you 500 pages of consent forms to sign. At least 200 or 300 of them consist of statements like, I understand that I am responsible for every single penny that the doctor chooses to bill under any circumstances, regardless of any insurance, regardless of anything. We may choose out of the goodness of our hearts as a personal favor to bill your insurance, but it doesn't matter, and I am still fully liable for all bills incurred, no matter what. Now the question is whether.
You actually read that before you signed it?
Now the
you
question.
Sign
now I do this for a living. So I do the halacha and the civil law for a living. So I have a professional interest in such things. So it's unclear both as a matter of law and as a matter of halacha exactly how binding such contracts are. But in a certain sense, it is consensual, like any other contract. In a certain sense, the law has notions of contracts of adhesion and other rules which might not necessarily. Might mean such contracts won't hold fully up in court. There's also the notion of certain things are non-waivable. I'm not a lawyer, certainly. I'm not going to venture too far into how binding those things are. Halacha probably doesn't necessarily make a difference. The fact that you borrow the money because you needed to, you know, to save lives or to treat your health, much as we, again, sympathize with you, probably doesn't change the basic civil law of debts. Certainly, you know, as Ray Winter was talking about, the idea of Torah's values and the idea that the Torah wants people to go beyond what the strict laissez-faire dog-eat-dog capitalism would indicate certainly would be a factor in these cases too. Certainly if we were setting policy on the policy level, one can make an argument that these types of debts should be treated differently. But as a matter of the basic principles, I don't know that it would be much different. That just brings us, I'm just going to make one final point before we conclude. That brings us to the fundamental question, which is when poskim are debating, when Jewish law authorities are debating, as I've said earlier, whether to apply the doctrine of minhag, a prevailing custom, to such laws, or whether to apply the principle of Dina Malchusa. At the end of the day, one key criterion they often use is this fair? Is this just? Is this something that's in the spirit of the Torah? And there's no easy answer for that. Republicans and Democrats will disagree wildly as to whether certain laws are great and good and wonderful and the spirit of the Torah, or whether they consist of simply theft, of robbing Peter to pay Paul. For example, on rent control legislation, where Jewish law authorities have been debating what perspective halacha should take for a century already, some poskim have said, some authorities have said, it's great, it's wonderful, that the job of the law is to protect the little guy from oppression by the big guys. Other ones said, absolutely not. You're simply preferring one class in society, the tenant class, against the other class. Landlords are simply class warfare. And it only helps existing tenants, and it disadvantages future tenants, and it's simply arbitrarily picking winners and losers. That's not the job of the law. The law should be protecting all classes equally. And we have some pretty vehement debates about how to define what does it mean. One of the key standards of Din Malchusa, of applying secular law, is this law for the good of society? We wouldn't need hundreds of people in Congress and endless pundits and endless economists if the question was simply a yes, no question. We could just ask our eight ball, is this law for the good of society? Yes, no, okay, pass it, don't pass it. Obviously, much of politics is deciding which law is up for the benefit of society, or which class of society should be protected at the expense of which class, and so on. There are no easy answers to these questions, and Jewish law authorities have been debating these questions for centuries, certainly, and have continued to debate them down to contemporary times. One of the most amusing reactions to rent control legislation around 1920 or so was by a fairly economically conservative-minded Jewish law authority who grumbled about it and said he was very skeptical. He felt it was institutionalizing theft. To use modern language, it was simply a taking of property from the landlord and awarding it to the tenant unfairly. And he said, particularly said, these laws are coming. These were post-World War I laws due to the disruption of housing stock by the war and displacement and so on of peoples. He said, particularly, and also the socialist revolutions that were sweeping across Europe. He says, so Rabbi Yeshua Babad, Chavetz HaSharon, says, particularly, he sniffs, he says, these laws are the product of the new parliamentarians, the socialists and the communists, whose entire goal is to redistribute wealth from the rich to the poor, an attitude which is antithetical to that of the Torah, he says, and therefore dismissed. Din Malchusa does not recognize such laws. That's about as kind of transparently political, economic perspective as you could ask for. He basically declares that the Torah is against wealth redistribution and is against laws whose purpose is to put a finger on the scale and privilege economically disadvantaged classes against those who are more blessed with resources. On the other hand, other authorities have taken the opposite view. Rabbi Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, one of the leading halachic jurists of the 20th century in America, ruled that, on the contrary, rent control is MS, is nachon, mekubal, it's appropriate and desirable, and the fact that it tilts toward the poor is an advantage, it's a feature, not a bug, that's the job of the law, is to protect those who need more protection, and it's wonderful, and it's the kind of thing we would do if we were making laws, he says. So you're going to find a wide divergence of opinions among contemporary authorities about which laws are appropriate and which not. As we mentioned earlier, in the 19th century, among the Sfardim, when it came to bankruptcy discharge, some of them said it's simply theft, it's simply gzela. Halacha has no business recognizing such customs, even if they are customs. Others said, no, it's a reasonable decision for the commercial society to make, and if they make it, we can endorse that. If that's the custom, that's the custom. So at the end of the day, whether halacha would recognize bankruptcy law would depend very much, to a large extent, on the perspective of the halachist in question as to whether this is something that's in. Obviously, you have to be an expert in bankruptcy law. You have to understand, or you have to know something about bankruptcy law to determine whether its motives and its practical effects are in the spirit of the Torah or not, which can be easier said than done. In practice, many, many, maybe even most authorities would, I believe, endorse bankruptcy law under the doctrines of Din Malchusa Dina or Minhag, particularly since it's usually the defendant who's invoking these protections against the plaintiff. Halacha has a pretty standard rule that in cases of doubt, the defendant will win. The burden of proof was always on the plaintiff as a matter of law, as a matter of fact, to establish his case. Given that there's some uncertainty in Jewish law as to whether these laws should be followed, defendant generally will win in a based in my understanding, because he can say that there are opinions that I'm right and you can't force me to pay against those opinions unless the basin has a particularly strong opinion in favor of the views that reject bankruptcy law, but many, as we've seen, many contemporary authorities rule that bankruptcy law is in line with Jewish values, is endorsed by principles such as Dina Malchus Adina and Minhag, despite the fact that there is no native equivalent other than Shemitah. And my sense is that many, perhaps most authorities, would actually rule in favor of following bankruptcy law, certainly in commercial situations, maybe even to some extent in personal situations as well.